Let's now turn to the subject of the study itself, the double dividends from climate aid. What do we know about the effects? This is particularly challenging as an impact study because most impact studies are about achieving a certain objective in development cooperation. But here there are two objectives. It's poverty and climate change, which is in the focus. So it's a question of, can you kill two birds with one stone? And what are actually the risks of missing both when you have these two targets? That's at the center of a report. That raises the stakes in impact evaluation, makes it more complex, difficult. We're very happy to have this report, which is the result of a teamwork of seven researchers, led by Gunnar Sjölin from the University of Gothenburg, and with a team with Subrenda Pataniak from Duke University in the U.S., Erin Sills from North Carolina State University, Eskil Mattsson, also from Gothenburg, and Madeleine Ostwald as well from Gothenburg, and Ariana Salas from the University of Costa Rica, and Daniel Ternald from Gothenburg. And we have Gunnar and Subrenda here, and Daniel also, I think, in the audience. So it's great to have you here. You're very welcome. And we look forward to hearing your presentation of a report, and that will be done by Professor Pataniak. I'm not introducing all of the team members here, but I should particularly say that Professor Pataniak from the Duke University has a long experience, extensive experience in environmental research, and been working with a variety of methods for impact assessment, for participatory approaches in impact assessment, for experimental studies, etc. Focusing on environment, energy, global health, and climate-related outcomes in low- and middle-income countries. You're very welcome. Take this seat here. We look forward to hearing about the report.
Thank you, Iba. That's the first time I heard EBA being called something different. And thank you, Gothenburg, for getting me involved in this project. So you got a good sense of the context from Mark about this is from one of Bjorn Lomborg's graphs, climate finance, climate aid, money to achieve both climate outcomes, that is this bad thing called CO2 that's getting in the sky and pollution, reducing it, but also simultaneously trying to do that without making people poorer. Okay, that's the double win part. Can we get there? For most parts, not only are world leaders holding hands, there's just a lot of gushing, warm feeling about this. And I'm not the person who's going to come in the morning and pour cold water on it, but I'm going to suggest that for most parts, we are operating in the dark. There are some places, some sectors, and some settings where you might be getting both things. But there's lots of places where we should be studying this problem where we still don't know, and we should be cautious before we jump. Okay. So Kim very nicely introduced the whole team, I'm the spokesperson for a very large team, but it's also about 3:30 by my body clock, so I might just fall asleep while standing here. No. So I'm going to stick to the script of the report. And if you don't follow what I'm saying, if it's confusing, there's generalities that I'm blazing past. It's in this very nice, thin, 124-page document. I was told that we were supposed to write it in 20 pages. But you could see from Mark's diagram, this spaghetti or this onion, whatever you call it, it's very hard to trace what is happening. And in the end, we ended up producing a 125-page document. Yeah. So the questions that we pose in this review are, what is going on with aid flows? And in some sense, you already got an answer to that from Mark's presentation. Lots of aid is in this business. I'll talk about that. A lot of it is also relabeling things to some extent, okay? And it's also quite confusing to sort it out for country by country because it used to be multilateral, now bilateral, becoming multilateral again. So it's a bit tricky to just say, what is Sweden doing that's different from the Nordic countries, which is different from what the world is doing, et cetera. Okay. The second question, which I really will focus most on, because perhaps that is unique to what we bring to this discussion, is do we know anything about the impact of these interventions? Okay. And here I'm going to say that all of this aid is relatively new. Anyone who's done impact evaluations knows that it takes some time for an intervention to get stabilized on the ground and start having effects. And so most of our analysis is looking in sectors where other things were going on, whether it was called climate aid or not. And those things that were going on, whether they were having any effect or not, okay? And so I will suggest that yes, for some things, like rural electrification, it seems like this is good news. For some things like planting trees, it's unclear what is going on, okay? And lastly, in the process of sort of trying to answer these questions, we of course have discovered that there is a gap between what scholars, evaluators tend to do or study, and the doers of the world, the action, the people who are actually making the aid disbursements and putting things on the ground. And this gap is too large, and we have to try to close the gap so that the science is actually helping the practice. Because otherwise, you know, these are two ships passing in the night, and that's very unfortunate. Okay? So how should we be thinking about this, especially given this dramatic rise in climate aid? So the plan is a very, very brief summary of aid flows, partly because I'm not the expert on the team for that. Then to move into what I would say is a systematic review. There are lots and lots of opinions. In this world and age of blogosphere, anyone can assert something confidently and put a nice picture and a graph. What we are bringing is a very systematic approach to what do we actually know. I think that's the differentiating contribution to this field, okay? So I will be a little bit nerdy about that and walk you through graphs that you can't probably see, but if you have a copy of the report, you should look at figure six, how we all did that. And lots of it is in the appendix, you know, the search terms that we used. And so I will then focus on two sectors, and there's a reason that we focused on these two sectors. We can discuss that in the panel discussion if necessary, but mostly forest conservation and household energy transitions, okay? There's for good reasons, those are two sectors that we have some findings on, okay? And lastly, sort of come up with the so what question. Okay, we've done the study for over a year, and we do have some strong recommendations. And these recommendations are not pie-in-the-sky ideas that we just dreamt up in conversations with the reference group and the secretariat and just our work. These are initiatives that NORAD, for example, has helped seed in collaboration with international networks that is taking ground. So there could be room to sort of replicate this. Okay. So here's one of the first figures. Okay. What is this basically showing? It's showing the rise of bilateral ODA. Okay. Not just in Sweden, but this is true across the world. The two colors are literally showing where the principal target was climate. In the middle of the night, I can hardly come up with a label of that. Teal, yeah, I guess so. No, not teal. Grayish blue, and then the green is where it's focused on. Tangentially, it affects climate. Okay, it's called significant. These are labels. You could call it whatever, right? But the point is that it's rising, okay, and it's bilateral, which means that there is now fragmentation going on and less coordination. The second thing is that the usual suspects, the big emerging developing countries, well, I don't know what to call China these days. It's hardly a developing country. It's pretty much most of the world. But China, India, South Africa, Brazil, Indonesia, Kenya, you know, these are the countries that are drawing most of what is called climate finance, the big ones. Not where all the poverty is, in Africa, okay? Or parts of India, which is very poor. It's just that one blob is sort of showing that. That's just telling you what the global distribution of climate finance is. Keep this map in mind, because when I show you a map of where the evaluations are being done, you will see where this no-due gap emerges. This is where the problem is. This is where the climate finance is flowing. But look at where the studies are being done. This is graph we've tried to change multiple times. Danielle here has fooled with it. Everybody on our team has tried to change it. What is it basically showing? Yes, interventions without environmental and climate markers, as hard it is to sort of label them, are increasing. That's the teal, blue, light blue line that's increasing, okay? But, and what is called climate, whether it's for mitigation or adaptation or some combination of mitigation and adaptation, is increasing. But what used to be called environment, biodiversity, nice cuddly things, that is going down. So it seems like there's been some displacement going on, okay? Everything under the environment sector is now being called climate, okay? Again, this is not my strong point, but this is a sense that I get from looking at the figures. Nordic countries are different from the rest of the world in how they disburse money. They certainly disburse more percent than everywhere else. But even between the Nordic countries, which are more comparable, you see different strategies, okay? So this is suggesting that there is something political, some sort of bilateral deals going on between specific countries and recipients, okay? So you'll notice different things there, but basically Norway tends to focus on mitigation, and it puts a lot of money into that, okay? And in contrast to Sweden, Germany, UK, which is not in this graph, and Norway focus more on energy and forests, okay? Even though those are the two sectors we sort of focus on in this, yeah? So there's different things going on with ADA, ODA. Finally, my last sort of comment on the aid flows with respect to that first question, what is going on with aid flows? You see that the two sectors that we focus on, energy and forestry, which gets tucked in with agriculture, are two of the top five sectors that are getting aid under climate, okay? Remember, climate is not a sector by itself. The sectors are still the old sectors, but the money is being targeted towards mitigation or adaptation or some combination of those activities. What do we mean by that? We still are aiming to try to cut emissions, cut CO2 emissions or black carbon emissions, and at the same time promote economic development. Okay, and so these are the sectors that are getting the top most amounts of money here. All right, so do we know if any of this is actually having any effect? What we do is called a systematic review or a systematized review. There's a whole industry around this. Okay, 3IE is probably best known for it. I forget the other acronyms. What is the difference between a literature review and a systematic review? I think the main difference is that at the outset, you specify your exclusion and inclusion criteria. So in our case, what we say is to know whether trees grow on money or money grows from trees or electricity is doing something good, we should have some data from the field. You know, you do something, you see some change, okay? So not an opinion, not a case study. There's room for that, but in our review, at least, we were looking at data from the field that proves that when you do X, you get more of Y, okay? So field-based evidence was the criteria for being included in our review. More than that, there has been a trend, and EBA has been a part of that trend to sort of push on proving causality, okay? Causality means that you are eliminating rival hypothesis. It's not possible that someone else is doing something else. The rainfall patterns change, and that's why there's more income. The climatic conditions explain why there's more forest. It is the action, the intervention, the project, the program, the policy that caused the outcome, okay? So usually, again, I'm not going to go into a long treatise about how to do impact evaluations. You have some baseline measurements that try to control for differences at the outset. You have a control group where nothing happens that you can contrast against. And then you have covariates, other measures that you might want to account for to see if the program, project, or policy is causing a change, okay? So we were looking only at studies that had some attempt to control for these things. The kinds of words we were looking for when we do our search, keywords, location, were developing countries, explicitly looking at co-benefits, certainly looking at the word climate and evaluation. Again, this is discussed in great detail in the multiple appendices that we have to our report about how we went about the search process and why we have such a large team. All right? I want to be very clear here. Again, this is not necessarily evaluations in real time of the investments that have flown in the last 3-4 years. It's impossible to look at that. Okay? But remember, these are monies going into traditional sectors that have been around as long as ODA has been around. Okay? So we are looking at things that were being done in the energy, household energy transition sector, in the forest conservation sector, from whatever source they got their fundings. But the things that they were doing then, do they reduce emissions in the sense of at least getting more forests on the ground? Do they actually reduce air pollution? Okay, do they improve human health? Do they reduce poverty? Do they improve income? Whatever those projects were, without necessarily being tagged to climate aid, which only came in the last 2 or 3 years. Okay. So here comes the confusing figure. It's figure 6, and you can probably see nothing there. Okay, what does it show? That there is an elaborate search process. When you put in those words, okay, you will find about 1,100 studies. It looks like there's a wealth of evidence that we can draw on to learn what we want to learn. Okay, if you look through that search process, okay, it will say the moment you start applying those criteria, it's field-based evidence, it tries to look at causality, all right, it immediately drops to something like 250. You see that first box. You lose about 85 or 70% of the what you have. Okay, then you start putting more criteria, you whittle it down, someone else reads it, you disagree. The second researcher says, no, I don't think this is doing what this is supposed to do. You're down to about 200. We meet with the reference group, and they say, well, did you look at the World Bank thing, or did you look at the different database? Okay, we add some. We lose some more. We're still at 190. In the end, we have about 100 studies, 80 of them in the energy space, okay, all of them looking at different aspects of energy transitions, and about only 20 of them in the forestry space, okay? This is what a systematic review is. You start with a full-blooded search, and you get what looks like a very promising scientific database from which to draw on, and then when you start reading them carefully, does this do what it's supposed to do? You lose a lot. 100 is still a large number. I expected it to be a smaller number when we first had conversations with the secretariat and with the reference group, but this is not a bad number to start with. So things that we are going to say from this point on is at least grounded on quite a few studies out there. Let me turn to the first sector. Okay, to some of you, this is all very alien. To some of you, this is very familiar. What is forest conservation? You want those forests because they are part of the world's lungs, but they also suck up CO2. When you cut them down, you lose it. So this is the greatest mitigation strategy that you can think of in some ways. And it's supposed to be low cost because these forests are growing in Indonesia, in Brazil, in Congo, in Africa. So let them be and you'll get good things. So the world has tended to sort of focus on 2, 3, 4 types of programs to protect forests in the tropical region. Probably the most common way is like national parks, protected areas. You negotiate with the government and you designate a big part of a big state and say, don't touch it. Okay? That used to be the traditional way. It's very command and control. There are maybe some soldiers and guns and people keeping other people out and deals with logging firms to not do it. Okay? The more new way of doing it to use market ways is called payments for ecosystem services. You don't cut it down and we'll give you money. Okay? This is very much in vogue. It was in the context of REDD Plus that this has sort of also gained more prominence. Okay, several of NORAD's initiatives are sort of around this idea, RED Plus initiatives. But these would be conservation programs. Are these effective? So when we put it to our test, you tend to see, remember that map that we saw earlier about where climate finance is going, and look at this map. That firstly, very few evaluations, only 22. They're in a sense focused on obscure countries like Malawi. We pick on that. Not on Indonesia, not on Brazil, okay? And yes, China features on pretty much everything anyone does, and it does feature in this too. Okay, there's about 5 evaluations in China of its forestry program, and that dominates sort of the literature here. 5 out of 20 are from China. Okay. So what can we learn at this point about forest conservation? I know I'm going to run out of time soon, and so I'm going to blaze through this. Remember that the panel will give us plenty of time to explore some of these, and then the report has more gory details. These payments for ecosystem services programs are somewhat successful. At minimum, they are bringing money into the hands of people, okay, of poor farmers. And they're particularly effective in Latin America, not so much in the rest of the world. Okay. There is some evidence that protected areas are effective. It's not shown in this report, but we have done some primary studies as well as systematic reviews that are, you know, because we'd already done it, we didn't want to repeat it, that defends that, as well as this whole idea of decentralizing forest management, letting local governments deal with how they want to do it rather than central command and control. All right. But there's really very little evidence on anything else, whether it works or it doesn't work. It could be working. It might not be working. We just don't know. All right. Everything that is in the climate domain is mostly focusing on REDD+, reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation. That is so recent that the evaluation results aren't out as yet. I have done one in Nepal and one in Indonesia, but it's very current. Okay, it's happening as we speak. There are people focusing on carbon outcomes, the climate part of climate aid, and on non-carbon outcomes like poverty, but usually they are different teams of researchers. They have very different assumptions, so it makes it hard to compare within the same project. Okay. In general, most of the impact evaluations focus on a very few subset of countries, okay, and not those necessarily with most amount of forest carbon in them. This is ironical, right? This is the no-do gap. Most studies that we have are retrospective, looking backwards. That means that they will fail a lot of these evaluation criteria because you did not set the baseline, okay? So you will tend to make mistakes, you will tend to have biases in your findings. Again, this is a repeat point. Few of the impact evaluation studies are in this context of climate change in that they weren't initiated after climate change. Okay, let me move to the second sector very quickly. This is not necessarily lights growing on trees, although that's a good image of what we are trying to do here. This is getting people who were cooking using biomass fuel to cook food every day. All of us today, hopefully, you weren't in your nice Norwegian cabin or, you know, up in the north in Sweden. You turned on a switch and you got coffee. You pressed a button and the espresso arrived. For a lot of people, they have to burn a piece of wood every morning to cook, okay? Or they have to use a kerosene lantern. So the transition would be they move to a fancier stove, okay, that uses electricity or solar to read, and then to a solar household system, and then to some off-grid community electricity supply, and then maybe on the grid. So that is the energy transition ladder, okay? So we are talking about basically rural electrification schemes, whether they're on the grid or off the grid, and some renewables such as wind, solar, and biogas, which is manure sort of translated into more efficient fuels. Okay. The other is taking the technology that is going to burn a piece of wood and extracting more efficiencies from it because of the construct of the packet. Yeah. The nicer, the camping stove that you might take camping, for example. All right. So there are lots of initiatives around this. There's a Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves that is UN-led. There is the Energy Plus that Norway had at one point. There is NDEV, which is a partnership between DFID, the Germans, and others. SC for All, a big group. So there's lots of initiatives that is pushing this as well. Okay. What do we know? Again, you see the prominence of China, and in this case, at least India, in the rural electrification context, both looking at grid expansion and off-grid. Okay. When we talk about more efficient stoves that burn fuel wood, again, the dominance of the evidence is from two countries, China and Mexico, and to some extent India. Okay, Africa, there's some in East Africa, but more or less nothing else going on there. Yeah. What? This is another graphic that is trying to make the point. What is it saying? That if you look across the columns, does an energy transition project reduce air pollution? Does it improve health? Does it reduce the amount of firewood that is burned? Does it increase incomes? And then there are two basic rows. If you use it through biomass cook stoves, or you use it through, you try to achieve it through advanced energy services, by which I mean electrification or solar, okay? Within those two broad rows, there's a rigorous way of sort of evaluating it, and there's a more basic way of evaluating it. The bigger the circle, the stronger the evidence, okay? So the more evidence is coming from somewhat weaker strategies to evaluate, sort of a regression with a few controls. The smaller circles are coming from the more advanced evaluations, okay? You see that there is some evidence that there are health improvements associated with this. You see almost no evidence that income or poverty reduces when you have an improved biomass stove. Okay. This is the sector that gets a lot of studies, but very few. There is one study that has found that there is an income effect of improved cook stoves. Okay, out of that base of 80, yeah, 80 only studied it, and out of that only one found an effect. Yeah. Summarizing here. Improved cook stoves, most studied energy intervention. Unfortunately, the robust evidence is associated with the advanced energy services like electrification. Weaker evidence that cooking technologies alone will sort of change much of anything, all right? There's a lot of focus on measuring health outcomes, but I think this is strongly a donor bias. This is not what developing country, the practitioners are calling for. They're looking more for social outcomes like fuel wood and income. Okay, but we don't tend to be measuring that. Not me, but the people who've been doing these studies. India and China dominate sort of this research portfolio. That you may say 40% of the world lives there, true. But in terms of the double goals of climate and poverty, there are large parts of South Asia and Africa and Latin America that is sort of left off the table here. Yeah. Again, this is not all climate aid. This is stuff that was already happening on the ground, and climate is going into the sector. I don't think I have a lot of time to explain why the political economy of why we have few impact evaluations, but I'll touch on a few points. You know, you could say that there is a market failure in the sector of providing rigorous impact evaluation. The suppliers and the demanders are not meeting. It's hard to discriminate between a good quality evaluation and something that is done quick and dirty, okay? So like bad money crowds out good money, the same thing is happening here. Oftentimes, a project itself will not benefit from the evaluation. It'll be the sector that will benefit. So the project has no incentive to try to do it because they will get no return, right? Remember, the study will be over by the time you find the results. The project will be over by the time you find the results. So it'll be the next project that is going to benefit. And very few people take that long-term perspective. Things that are not, things that are completed after the project cycles are not considered, et cetera, et cetera. So we tend to ignore things with diffuse, distant impacts. There's differences in evidentiary standards. Scientists are obsessed with not being proven wrong, so they're always looking for that 99% confidence interval, okay? Policymakers don't have the patience for that. They have to act. They've got people who are waiting for action. So that gap is, again, part of the problem here. Yeah. So in the report, we argue for how we have to find a middle ground here. Okay. Not just saying whether there is an impact or not. Why was there an impact? The theory of it. For whom? Under what conditions? And this is obviously going to call for more mixed methods and multiple disciplines. Yeah. In conclusion, I think I've sort of hit upon these. Climate finance is increasingly bilateral. A lot of it is focused on climate outcomes, not necessarily poverty outcomes, okay? Not a whole lot of new initiatives in place to sort of launch that, okay? But there are some promising signs, and I'm going to talk about a few, with sort of preceding it with the following recommendations. First recommendation is, of course, trying to do something about the fragmentation. And the fact that we have this panel here that is going to talk to each other, will take notes, is obviously coordinating. More and more of that needs to be happening, okay? So that everybody's not going off in their own way, yeah? And to the extent that you can sort of link it to hard data, hard evidence, that's good. I think this is one of the sure bets out there, advanced energy services, a lot of data and proof that this is actually working. Not so clear about forest conservation and biomass cook stove. We need sort of more hard data on that. It's very important to close this no-do gap, and we offer some mechanisms to get there. We have to incentivize the scholars to pursue what is actually happening on the ground rather than dream up some projects in the universities and then go implement them, okay? They will be willing to do that if there is some scope to experiment and learn in the climate finance space. Not if you are, they won't do it if they don't have the room to sort of play around, okay? So certainly better targeting, just the two disconnects between the maps should give you some sense of where the evaluation should be focused, all right? And definitely only fund and support things which look at both outcomes rather than one outcome. So, for example, the C4 project that NORAD has supported, it looks at whether reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation is going to reduce carbon emissions and improve poverty outcomes. And we have, it's pan-tropical, 6 countries, 3 continents. It is well-funded, it's long-lived, researchers involved right from the get-go, which allows them to sort of set baseline in terms of incomes, livelihoods, perceptions, also get ecological measures. Stakeholders evolved right from the get-go so that there is alignment of scholars and the program managers, okay? And then we're working with pilot projects so that there's some scope to sort of modify things at the planning stage itself, yeah? Similarly, Gunnar will probably talk about Ethiopia's very ambitious plan to become a middle-income country in the next 15 years without increasing emissions. And there is the EDRI, Ethiopian Development Research Institute, is heavily steeped in sort of trying to do that, okay? With an autonomous sort of mandate, local capacity building, et cetera, et cetera. Lastly, this is my main claim. This is not going to be cheap or easy. And I say this all the time, everywhere, to my class, in every other setting. Anything that is easy and cheap is not worth doing. It's already being done, okay? This is hard. I understand that, okay? The fact that you're going to study real-life programs, involve evaluators in the design stage, better matching of where the problem is and what is being studied, multidisciplinary evaluation teams, this sounds like a lot of work. And no wonder there are so few quality evaluations, okay? But that doesn't mean that we, all of us here, donors, scholars, implementers, evaluators, sort of abandon this challenge, because there is a lot at stake here, right? That all that warm, fuzzy feeling at COP21 is kind of riding on hard evidence sort of coming with teams of people sort of rallying together, okay? And this is going to a very large extent, rely on domestic capacity building in country, in Africa, in Latin America, in South Asia, that is actually able to do it. It's not sort of consultants flying in to sort of being able to do it. Yeah. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Subrando, and thanks to the team for the report. We're delighted to have it. As you know, and you see here, it is really a complex subject and a difficult study to penetrate because it covers a lot of different fields, and it's a short study. You can say that considering that it is about the double dividends and whether they are realizable or not, here you have a study which is both addressing what is done, and it has a comparative analysis on that, looking not only at Sweden, but also at other countries. It looks about what are the impact in 2 different sectors. It raises the stakes about how do you look at impact, and it comes up with practical recommendations for the future. So that counts to five. So killing five birds with one stone, which is a good thing done here. And I would also emphasize that the team has put in a huge amount of work here, starting with this more than 1,000 different studies and finally ending with fewer and treating those in the analysis here. So thanks a lot for that. And I really recommend the report, which both has a good focus main section, but also really interesting annexes for those who want to dig deeper into the two sectors that are around here. And also the lists of references to evaluation reports, where you can easily find more things to read if you want to do that after the study.